Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 169 with the title, Building Bridges in a Biased World. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Sonia Perez. Sonia is an engineer and leader in the energy industry who has become a passionate DEI champion, advocating for inclusion, neurodiversity, and psychological safety in the workplace. And when I asked Sonia to describe her superpower, she said that it is turning lived experiences into inclusive leadership, and most importantly, action. Hello, Sonia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely brilliant. So you're the opposite end of the UK to me. So I'm in Portsmouth and you're up in Aberdeen. Is that right? So is it, I know us Brits, we like to talk about the weather. So what's the weather like up there at the moment? So we're in middle of March?
Yeah, well, it's freezing cold.
Snow? Have you had some snow recently?
No, but the forecast says maybe again. We seem like we were getting into spring and then just went wrong again.
Yeah, it's down to the zeros here. So yeah, I think it's an icy blast over the whole country. So yeah, is what it is. So you're an engineer by profession and obviously a leader as well. We talked about that. So how have you kind of lent into the DEI journey or the EDI journey? And what impact has your own lived experience and background? You know, we talked in the green room just before we went live about intersectionality or the depth of our personalities and our lived experience. How has that impacted you at work and in your life?
Well, I guess I came into DEI incidentally. It wasn't really thought of or on purpose, but it was more my lived journeys. I became a mum 6 years ago. And well, I guess my experience as an engineer and as a leader before was different to after. Suddenly you have to, well, I guess balance your work life with your family and your personal life. Well, there isn't much of personal life, to be honest, if you have to compensate work with children. And at that point, we started suspecting that my daughter was neurodivergent. And then I hear, well, this is genetic. It's like, oh, okay, well, I wonder if it's me too. Yeah, so we start investigating. It's like, well, yeah, that's definitely me as well. And how, I guess I was going through a really difficult time as well, personally. And how that kind of neurodiversity, my new-ish identity as a mother, as a single mother, actually, and the mental health and so on. Well, it basically just took me into a really steep learning curve about DEI, but one that I actually am really proud of.
Wow. So what's been the biggest challenge you faced, you know, as a woman? Can I use the phrase a woman of colour? Because you're not white British, are you, by background? Has that impacted your experience in the workplace as well?
I wouldn't say so. I think even though my skin may be a little bit darker than the British, well, not every British, obviously, but just I would say is still white in that part. So I don't think I've had. If anything, people like the colour of my skin.
Tanned, I suppose. Yeah. What's your original background? Is it Portuguese, Spanish? That sort of general area? Spanish, yeah.
I guess that's the one general area. the one thing that I find about my nationality is the jokes about, you know, how we are lazy and how we sleep siestas all the time. And people who know me for a very long time will confuse my name by someone else's who's Spanish. Like we're interchangeable.
I suppose there is, if you've got a US background, you're more likely to be Hispanic Mexican, I guess, as opposed to European Spanish. But like the Brits, the Spanish also had an empire and conquered half the world and exported our culture and language and religion to other parts. And the Portuguese did it as well. And the Dutch were all guilty of spreading our culture to other parts, unwanted often.
No, but I haven't really faced the big, I guess, challenges due to my nationality. I think I'm an immigrant, and you know, you will always find people who would ask you to go back home. But frankly, it's not really been an experience that's shaped my life. It's maybe happened once or twice, but I know other people get it a lot worse.
So you've been in engineering STEM sector for most of your career. It has a reputation for being very male-dominated, for want of a better expression. How have you found that challenge to navigate as a young woman to start with, and then developing your career and becoming more experienced?
Frankly, So I've always been, well, either the only woman in the room or one of the very few back from university. I think at the time I really wasn't aware of any difference in treatment, but when I look back now, I see it now. I think, well, I felt like I couldn't really be myself. I had to fit in with all the other men. I had to behave like them. And that didn't really, it felt awkward, because it's like you're acting. There's always this kind of, well, sexist jokes, and you kind of have to laugh with them. And it's not really funny. But I don't know, sometimes you can become an object. I think as I've, like, once finished university and I started work, I found everyone quite supportive of me. I've been offshore in all platforms. I've been as well in the oil and gas industry, but in onshore surveys. I think I kind of fall into this. I know I'm not the only one who does it, because I've seen other colleagues do the same. I play dumb, and that works quite well, because I think people expect me to be dumb. So rather than the arrogance, like if you are very like assertive, or you're sure of yourself, you're confident, then they think you are being arrogant. And if you make a mistake, then, well, that's it kind of explodes in your face. So playing dumb kind of works for a lot of people.
So what you're effectively saying is you're appeasing people to ensure that you're successful by not creating waves. And you know that if you, as you say, become assertive, become more dominant, then you won't be accepted as much. So you have to hide who you are, really. Just an intelligent, capable engineer has to kind of limit their own potential by dumbing it down. Is that what you're saying you've learned to do?
Yeah, I suppose, like, when maybe I'm asking a question, I mean, I know the answer to it, but, you know, you don't, I think people feel a bit more like defensive when a woman challenges them. So you don't really challenge them straight on. You ask questions and you kind of play dumb, like, you know, I'm not too sure about this. You know, it's not like you just go and tell them. And I know there's a big difference between the way I did it as a leader and how other colleague who are men dealt with it, but then they didn't have the pushback that I did.
Right. So how do you succeed yourself in a world where you have to kind of minimize like that? How do you take advantage of opportunities where people maybe see you as not confident because that's the way you're portraying yourself?
I don't have an answer to that. I would love to know the answer. I think, well, and throughout my life, I would say I've achieved quite a lot. How did I do it? Well, I think, well, looking back, it's more about the people who you know, is the networking. It's that is people with whom you can be yourself, and they will respect you and they value you for who you are, because they can see everything about you. And then there is the other people who, well, feel a bit more threatened by me or other people or other women showing who they really are. I would say I had a lot of support with, you know, my network, my village, let's say. So it's always about doing the right thing, being kind to other people, being respectful, always trying to learn different perspectives, because in that way, people start kind of wanting to work with you. They start like learning from you. They see the value in you. I think that's what got me where I was, but I don't know how it continues from there, because it really depends on who you're working with.
Yeah. Obviously, your daughter is going to be entering the workplace at some point soon, or maybe not soon, but in the years to come. What advice would you give her entering the workplace and building her career, knowing what you know about how you've had to integrate into the workplace?
That's quite deep thought. I would say the first thing would be to build her village. That's going to be really key, because there's always going to be people who will want to see her fail. And it probably it's not going to be personal, but it's more going to be like a more systematic belief. So, but there will be people who want her to succeed. So it's about finding that village, that network, that is going to support her, that's going to give her that kind of perspective that you may lose when people, when you don't feel like you can be yourself, or you start like what other people think or say start rubbing on you, like I'm not good enough. There's always this village who will tell you, even in the times where you don't believe in yourself, that you are really good just the way you are. So I would say that's the most important thing. And I think take space, take your space. I mean, it's the more you talk about things, the more open you are, the more you demand, you know, to be just like everyone else and having the same opportunities, the more likely is that you will get them. I think, you know, if people just remain quiet and accept the status quo, it's never going to change. And that's, you know, what the previous generations to us did. We're not starting from scratch, you and I. And, you know, our children won't start from scratch, because we are fighting that battle as well.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned psychological safety in the opening. It's not right that you have to kind of hide part of you. If you think about some of the four tenets of psychological safety, one is inclusion safety, being yourself, isn't it? And having to cover yourself means that you're fitting into other people's expectations, which is a huge mental cognitive load to have to think about that all the time, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think, to be honest, I didn't realize I was doing it until very recently. Just when I mean, neurodivergence, what is that? I mean, back when I was younger, it was only boys that were neurodivergent, and just, you know, the ones that showed neurodivergence in a very stereotypical way. So there is a lost generations of people who didn't get diagnosed at the time. So at the moment, I mean, I got diagnosed, what was it, like a year ago? So I'm still learning who I am. And I remember when I got the diagnosis and I called my mom to tell her. And I wasn't sad, I wasn't angry, I was okay. But I burst into tears and I was trying to explain to my mom, I'm okay, I'm actually okay. I don't know why I'm crying. It's just like this overwhelm of suddenly just looking back and seeing, you know, all of this happened because of this kind of how my brain works and how I was trying to fit in with everyone else. So it was quite an overwhelming feeling, realizing that I've been masking my whole life without even knowing. And now I'm not so good at masking anymore. I don't know why, but now that I know that, you know, this is who I am, it's a lot harder for me to try to pretend to be someone that I'm not.
I suppose age, experience, and, you know, you get to that point, as you say, you know it's not you. You know, you just this is who you are, and you're not having to sort of, you know, cover up things that you previously would have done because you thought you were failing, but actually it's just part of your identity. And yeah, I think the older you get, though, the less tolerant you are of people's perceptions of you, and you're more likely to be yourself, I think. Become more confident in your ability.
And the thing is, I do have a lot of people. Well, my family is, well, we're really close, even in the distance, but they are very supportive. They've been learning as well now. Like, my stepdad started studying psychology just to understand, you know, my daughter and me, like, our neurodivergence. And my mom's read all the books in the world now. It's a shame because, you know, they didn't know before, and neither did I. And now it's kind of trying to catch up, you know, with all of this. My friends are very supportive, and there is a lot of people at work that are very supportive of me as well. And so this is really nice to see that, you know, it's okay for me to be who I am.
Mm. You said in your notes that you submitted for the show that your, if you like, awareness of your own neurodiversity stemmed from your daughter's neurodiversity and the diagnosis of her, and you saw traits in her that you'd recognise in yourself. So what were the key things maybe in your daughter that you spotted that resonated with you?
It wasn't obvious to start with. She was 3 years old when this started, and it was behavioural. Me, I've always been a really calm child. I never had like any issues, but she, a few years down the line, we figured out it was sensory processing. She had a big issue with that, especially like clothes and stuff. I've never experienced that. But she started, well, when we start looking at that behavior as a very young child, it sometimes leads into neurodivergence and how children understand the world and how they're processing information. So I wondered if, like, is it ADHD? Is it autism? And then apparently something came up that I had never heard about, which was giftedness. And I thought, giftedness? Okay, well, the kind of conversations that my daughter was having with me when she was 3 years old were not what you would expect from a child. It's like, that's the conversation I would expect to have with an adult, talking about, like, well, really philosophical matters like, you know, death and pregnancy, miscarriages. I had just had one, and relationship breakdowns. And it just caught me completely off guard. And so giftedness, ADHD and autism have very similar traits, actually. And I knew nothing about that. So it's not recognized in the UK yet, but it is in the US and in Spain, and maybe in other countries as well. So I personally didn't think she got that from me. And it's this thing about ADHD and being a woman as well, that you always think that you're not smart enough. For example, I was in class, and I was always a really good student, and I had really good grades, but I just couldn't pay attention when the teacher was kind of giving the lecture. And I thought, that's because I'm not, you know, smart enough. And so, yeah, she's not diagnosed yet because she's very young, but I got my diagnosis, and I was really surprised to see that not only I had ADHD, but I was gifted. And I thought, well, I always thought I wasn't that smart.
So what, you talked about gifted, and how has that manifested itself in your career? Mm. There aren't many women still in STEM subjects, and I've always associated, rightly or wrongly, with neurodivergence being engineering, technical type people. They communicate better with things than they do with people, often. So do you think that has had an impact on you being able to focus on engineering topics?
I don't know. I mean, It's a bit difficult knowing where, you know, the autism, ADHD and giftedness kind of ends to start and where the other one begins. For the giftedness, it's been more about feeling easily bored. I mean, I need a challenge, and my motivation cycles kind of peak when I get something new, something challenging, something I'm learning from, but kind of dissipates quite quickly and easily. I'd say, like, the other thing was authority. If someone doesn't justify something, well, reasonably well to me, then I find it difficult to follow it. I think from the ADHD point of view, I am not very good with details. And you would know that, you particularly, because I turned up to this meeting a month ago on the 14th, on the 14th of March, because I scanned through, like, you know, reading, and I'd seen the 14. And yeah, this is not the first time it happened. So I knew it was probably my fault that no one turned up to the call rather than someone else's. So, the numbers aren't the best for me, the details, but I'm really good with abstract thinking. I'm really good with empathy, for example, like talking to people, understanding what's important to each person. And building that trust. From the engineering point of view, what I was really keen on is understanding why things happen, how things work. It's like that kind of puzzle.
I've never been diagnosed. I'm not sure whether I was ticking enough boxes, but I share a lot of your kind of thinking there. You know, every time I find something new, I want to rip it apart, put it back together, rip it apart, put it back together. And then once I've done that a few times, I go, bored with that now. What's next? Another shiny thing. So I've got a whole catalogue of things I've had a good go at, and I've become a very quick expert on, and then pushed it to one side. Because my background's in IT, and I found that extremely challenging for most of my life, and really got involved with it. And all of a sudden, in my 40s, I got bored with it. I just thought, I can't do it. I've had enough of this. It's not exciting me anymore. I want to find the new shiny object. I share a lot of that with you. It's important to keep stimulating the brain. And I'm either 100% in or I'm 100% out. I don't do it in the middle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, middle grounds don't really exist in my head.
No. Yeah, if I'm not into it, I'm not into it. That's it. You're not going to persuade me. But to me, that's quite powerful, because I can become very obsessive and very hyper-focused on something and achieve a lot. And I'll focus on it for weeks, 24/7. I'll be thinking about it. I'll be lying in bed. I'll be waking up with it. I want to put it into action. And say something else will occur, and I focus on that. And it's like, it's interesting that it's a great attribute to have if you want to get stuff done, as long as you've got someone behind you picking up what you've left and saying, right, okay, that's where you go. You take it on from here, isn't it?
So my mentor, a very wise person, once told me, like, you don't have to know everything. You just have to surround yourself with people who can fill in your gaps. And I thought that was really helpful and useful. I mean, this is a lot of people just tend to take everything in, and they don't know how to, I guess, share that work and delegate. But for me, that comes naturally. I think not everyone sees it as a strength. I think it is. I think, you know, as an individual, you're bound to have gaps. No one can know everything. No one can be good at everything. But if you know what you're really good at, then you can focus on that. And there'll be other people who are really good at the things that you're not so good at. I think that works really well.
Yeah, there's another quote. I can't remember if this is accurate or not, but I think it's something like, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room, because you want to be able to grow and learn. And so find a different room to help you grow and learn. So I think, it's important that you don't have to be an expert at everything, and you don't need to be the authority on everything. And it's important that you have your own learning zone. How's your daughter finding that sort of the way her brain works? Is it a very similar way to yours in terms of being very hyper-focused and picking things up and then moving on quickly?
It's hard to say at this stage. I think I can already see what she's really good at. I think she's really good with numbers at the moment. Her logic thinking is, well, outstanding. But then she struggles with other things, like sitting down and actually if you don't sit down and force yourself a little bit, you never get into hyperfocus. And I think she struggles with the kind of sitting down. I think like she's really smart, and she just fits in wherever she goes. I think she's the queen of masking, though. but she's really outstanding.
Fabulous, fabulous. So in the notes, it says here you've chaired numerous villages, if you want to use your word, women support groups, neurodiversity network groups, internal employee resource groups. And presumably you've also been involved with industry body groups as well to promote women or neurodivergent women across the STEM sector?
Well, it's something that I'm trying to do just now with the iMickey. So I'm a member of the iMickey. It's just a really, I guess, obvious next step. At work, I do the women and women plus group, which is basically for any underrepresented gender We've got two others. We've got the LGBTQ+, and then we've got NeuroDivergent group. I'm a member of that one too. But yeah, as I'm keen to do as much as possible so that you know, I can make a difference, a positive difference.
Are we? That's the question I often challenge myself with and other people with. We're better than we were, but are we really making progress?
I would say yes, definitely. Because I can see like the difference between when I was growing up to now. I mean, people are talking about everything now. We're talking about neurodivergence. We didn't do that before. We're talking about, well, gender and gender identity. We're talking about sexuality. We're talking about so many different things that we didn't do before. I can see, I mean, all these things take time. I don't think we will see the end of it in this generation. But I can certainly see a huge difference. And the fact that there are so many people talking about it, you know, people are now rising up and talking about these things. That's really important. Not everyone felt safe to do it before. And there was a lot of things that we didn't know about.
You mentioned in the notes that you've had some challenges in your life around your own mental health, going through an eating disorder phase of your life. Do you think that's all linked to some of your neurodiversity, or do you think that they're sort of separate threads?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that question, because I did investigate this. I did some research because I wondered, and there is a very clear link with my neurodivergence and my gender. So the eating disorders specifically, I've not been diagnosed with this, but I know that I've always had a bit of an unhealthy relationship with food and my weight. And, you know, it can either be through, you know, just eating compulsively or being really fixated on my weight. So it can go both directions. I know, like, when I was growing up, when I was a teenager, you know, like, you want to fit in. And I think I didn't know back then, but obviously I sensed that, you know, maybe struggled a little bit more to fit in with the rest of the people. And, you know, body image is really important to whether you fit in or not, especially like as a woman or as a girl now, you are expected to look in a specific way. And this is almost like to please men. And well, yeah, so a lot of it, like, I think, you know, back then, I wouldn't say I had anorexia. I wouldn't say I had bulimia, but I would say that I was really obsessed with my weight and I was probably at my lowest weight. And then the thing that happens to me is eventually I snap out of it. When you were talking about before, like, you get really obsessed with something for a while and then you lose interest. So that happens to me as well with this kind of things. So I lost interest. And then I think, you know, the emotional eating came, like, you know, as you grow up and you start getting more responsibilities, you feel like you don't fit in a lot of instances. It's almost like you're on your own fighting with the whole world, you know, and you just feel like kind of sense of isolation, of lack of sense of belonging. That kind of need for a deep connection isn't really met, even though, you know, you may have friends and a partner and family. You know, you're really close to all of them. But I found like that kind of sense of belonging wasn't never there, like 100%. And I started like compulsively eating. I mean, I have a sweet tooth. That doesn't help, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, as you grow older, that becomes more difficult because you have even more responsibilities, you know, at work. If you kind of went up in your career, you know, you progressed. If you have now children, and, you know, relationships are difficult as well. All the kind of responsibilities in the household, and then you eat like all the kind of stuff that you shouldn't be eating.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I noticed, well, in my research, I saw that, I can't remember the figures exactly, it's in the LinkedIn videos, but basically neurodivergent women are a lot more likely to get an eating disorder than any other person.
Mm. Someone explained to me that I personally have what I would call an addictive tendency. So I tend to binge on stuff. So I had a poor relationship with alcohol most of my life. I would never describe myself as an alcoholic, but I used to consume excess amounts regularly, often in binge format, you know, 2 or 3 days, I would be drinking very, very heavily, and then a habit during the week. And my weight has also tended upwards most of my life. And I've, on occasions, done something about it, and I've lost 10 stone, give or take, and I've put it back on over the course of another 3 or 4 years. So I've got this, look at my weight chart, it looks like an M. So I go up and then down, then back up again, and then back down again. So I'm currently on my downward cycle. I've lost about 7.5 stone in the last year and a bit. So, yeah, I get what you're saying, that becomes, you know, if I see a buffet, I don't have a stop button. It's kind of, oh, I want a bit of that, I want a bit of that, I want a bit of that. And suddenly your plate is like a volcano erupting all over the place. But it's so difficult to take one of something. So I know that about me now. And that's why I often ask other people to pick me a plate. Can you fill my plate up for me? And they go, why? Well, I say, you'll fill it up reasonably. I'll overindulge. So yeah, that's the secret I've learned, is get someone else to fill your plate, and then don't go back for seconds. Just stop at that point.
So what I read was that ADHD is people with ADHD are more likely to experience binge eating disorder, because that kind of impulsivity. Well, we are more likely to get into addictions. For me, it was chocolate. Maybe bread as well. And people with autism, well, in particular, women are more likely to experience anorexia and bulimia because of that kind of, rigidity, being rigid with their habits.
Yeah, I think you're right. You become very focused on other things, and eating is just either something you're fixated on or you're not bothered by it. And I go through phases where if I'm in a hyper-focus mode, I could spend all day and think, oh, I suddenly feel hungry at the end of the day. Think, oh, I haven't eaten today, have I? And you just forget all about it, don't you?
So that's actually something that happened to me quite a lot, and probably a lot of people with ADHD. And I went to a nutritionist who's worked with people with ADHD before, and she was saying that you need an alarm, because you can't go, like, if you go into hyper-focus mode, then you're going to forget, you're going to ignore your hunger cues, and then you're going to be, like, so hungry that, you know, you want to do with, like, healthy food. You'll just want the unhealthy stuff, and you'll binge eat, and then, you know, everything is just going to go mad, like your sugar levels. And so, yeah, an alarm and just being conscious. But yeah, when you get, sometimes I find it like, you know, this kind of hyper-focus happens when in the least convenient time. And then it's like, you just can't get up. I mean, I just need to continue. It's like, this is like this kind of supernatural force keeping you from, you know, eating, drinking, going to the toilet.
Yeah. No, I get that. It's hard sometimes when you have this intersectional makeup, not to focus on sort of parts of your identity, because if you're not careful, you get labeled as being one thing or another thing. But really, that's not what excites you. That's not who you are. And do you find that if you're not careful, talking about neurodiversity or some of your mental health challenges or something that's gone in your past, suddenly creates this label about you that you don't really want to own?
Yes, and that's why I thought for a while whether I wanted to discuss this or not, because what I've learned is that neurodiversity presents very differently to different people. I mean, usually it's not even one. You experience more than one at the same time. Mental health, culture, gender, there's so many different things. The way I and other friends that or colleagues that I know are neurodivergent, I mean, we're so different. Even me, my daughter, we are so different.
I'd have to ask you about what you do day to day, because I noticed the notes. You work onshore and offshore. Offshore sounds to me like the rigs. Is that the rigs you're working on, or is that offshore somewhere else?
No, that was in the rigs, but that was many ages ago, before I became a mum. So I went to some rigs in the North Sea.
So what sort of engineering were you doing there? Is it the drilling part or the what's your specialism, if you like?
Well, mechanical. That's what I do.
Mechanical. So designing motors or cutting or structural?
I don't design anymore, unfortunately. It's more like checking that someone else's design or, you know, yes, we're checking in the energy industry that things are safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine like if something went wrong offshore. Well, I mean, it's happened before, so we don't have to imagine it. And that's what we're trying to stop.
So you're in sort of QA and risk and quality assurance sort of side. Okay. So obviously becoming a mum changed a lot of your career aspirations and availability to get in stuff. So what's your new passion? Is it about being more in a leadership role or?
I would say, yeah, leadership was probably one of the things I was really interested in. I'm not in a leadership position now, but I was for 6 years. And I found that, well, I got into it by accident, let's say. You know, we were talking about how when you've done this for a while, you just lose that motivation, you want something else. And the one thing that came up was a leadership position. And I got it. And I would say I quite like working with people. I like helping people. I like making a difference to people's lives because, you know, work is not just about work. It doesn't end there. You know, it kind of follows the person wherever they go. So that was something I was quite passionate about. I'm not sure what I'm passionate about now. I like my hobbies. Yeah, I have one because I don't have time for more, but writing is something I really enjoy.
And do I see from the notes, you've got two master's degrees, one's in engineering and one's in creative writing. So you've thrown yourself into the writing as quite a big hobby.
It's quite big. It's like, well, maybe, I don't know, who knows, maybe one day. I'll be a published writer, who knows.
So you've written lots of novels, but you've never published them. Is that where you are with it?
Well, I wouldn't say I've written lots. I've written two and a half.
Written two and a half.
And then sadly, there is not many. There's not a lot of time. It's like, you know, like with writing, or when as an engineer, I work in front of a computer all day. So my hobby is not one that actually encourages me to socialize and go outside, which makes it really hard for me just to switch from one side, from you know, one job in front of the computer to the next one in front of the computer on my own. I think I struggle a little bit to find the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, in today's modern life, there's always something to do, isn't there? As I say, being a full-time mum is a full-time job, and we shouldn't make excuses for that. I think it's a necessary part of development, because I look back at my childhood and my mum was a stay-at-home mum. She effectively stopped work when she got married at the age of 23, 24. And she had three children. I was the first. And she didn't go back to work or start work again until her very late 40s, when we were all, I think my youngest brother was probably 12, 13 at the time, going to school, and she became a teacher. So she got into teaching and into the junior and primary school. But she was a very great mother, and I value my upbringing of having a full-time mum. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be a latchkey kid these days where you don't have a full-time parent around. So it's a real challenge, though, trying to divide up your desire to be a great parent versus your need to earn a living. It's a challenge we have, isn't it?
Well, I would say, apart from the need of earning a living, which, you know, most of us have, it's also, you know, that sense of achievement. I mean, being a parent is not something I would change for anything in the world. I love it. But there is more to me than that. And I think there is more to a lot of us than being a parent. There is a lot of, you know, dimensions to who we are. And I think, you know, whether it's my job or, you know, my hobbies or, you know, something else, I find it important to find that time to actually grow, to learn, to get that sense of achievement from life.
I've heard it said several times that, you know, as a woman, you have to choose. Yeah, there is a choice to be made between a career and motherhood or parenthood. But often men don't have to have that dilemma. And I don't want to stereotype anybody here, but have you found that challenge yourself, where there's a conflict between having a career and being a great mum, or being the mum you want to be, as being in conflict?
I would say so, yes. Yeah, but I would argue that men are in the same position, while women often choose family. men are forced to choose work. So, I mean, we are all sacrificing something. Men are sacrificing time with their families, while women may be sacrificing time, well, their careers. I just recently heard something from in the Women Plus ERG is support group at work, and it was quite profound. It's like you can have everything, just not everything at the same time. And that was good because I thought, like, I didn't feel like I could have the career that I want, plus, you know, be a mother and be with my child. But that is just now, isn't it? Life is long. Hopefully, life is long and things will change.
Yeah, it's interesting as you say that. My mum, that I'm a super fan of my mum, is in 86, something like that, 86 this year. And my father passed away a couple of months ago. I haven't been in a nursing home for a couple of years. And she's now establishing her single life, if you like. You know, she's now rediscovering that having no responsibility for another person, not being codependent on anybody, being able to make her own decisions on things that she probably couldn't have done for most of her married life. And she's now finding this freedom. But it's taken her a while to become comfortable with not having to ask or not having to think about something, just being ultimately selfish, doing what she wants to do. And you say that you can have everything, just not all at once. So I think she's now having the life that she had to give up or park in her early days to now experience in her late 80s. And she's going for it big time. She said, I want to keep going until I'm 100 at least. And yeah, if you use it or lose it, as she keeps saying. So you've got to keep active, you've got to keep out there, get doing stuff. She goes to yoga, she goes to Pilates classes in the local town hall. She meets with her friends for coffee, and yeah, she does loads of stuff now. She's busy as I am. It's incredible. Yeah, really, really, really powerful woman, and I love her to bits.
That is quite inspirational, yeah. I think probably in the past, both women and men, and well, anyone, I don't think anyone had the choice to do whatever they wanted to. It was more like what they were expected to do, the role they were supposed to take in society. But it is changing now. You asked me before, do you think it's changed? Well, the fact that your mom is able to now have a different, very different life, I guess it's a proof of that.
Yeah, it's. But she lived a very traditional married life. You know, she got married in 1963. So she was born in the 30s. My father was born 6 years older than her. And they were kind of a product of their upbringing where, you know, man goes to work, woman stays at home, sort of thing. And that was kind of predestined from the indoctrination their parents had given them and the village they were being supported by. My father was in the Navy. So it was a very much, you know, the Navy was men and the naval wives were women at home or living in naval quarters. And I came along and my mum became a mum. And I guess that was, she didn't know any different. And even when I got married in the late 80s, that was still the model. Women were kind of still really expected to stop being a worker and become a mother and a stay-at-home parent. And it was, I think we didn't see any evolution of that. Maybe it was the Spice Girls and girl power that came along in the 90s that started waking people up to the idea you can have choice here.
Yes, and I think perhaps nowadays we see more women going to work and men staying at home with their children. I mean, there is some traditional still kept there because, I don't know, but my experience and the experience of many other people, I think as well, is that yes, we can go and work if we choose to. We still have to deal with most of the stuff at home as well. So it becomes like, yeah, it becomes like a lot.
Yeah, we still have gendered roles, don't we? And someone once said to me, you know, it's all very well having a stay-at-home dad and a go-to-work mum, but there's that point when your child falls over and bangs their head or bangs their knee, who do they scream? Do they scream for dad or do they scream for mum? Often they scream for mum. So whatever happens, mum still becomes the primary responsibility for keeping the child alive. Whereas fathers often, even though they're committed, they don't have the same the same relationship with their child, I don't think. And I don't, that's not a fault. It's just a biological thing, I think.
I am seeing this changing quite a lot. I mean, not with everyone in every household. There's still a lot of traditionality. But I can see dads being a lot more involved, probably 50-50, sometimes even more. But yeah, I guess you still see a lot of the more traditional kind of thinking and lifestyle.
Yeah. When our children were young, I was working all over the world. I worked up in Scotland for a year as well, near Glasgow. And I missed out on a huge amount of our child's development at that time. We had the luxury of my wife was able to stay at home a lot this time, so because I was working. And I look back on it, not with regret, but with a certain sadness that I wasn't there for a lot of their lives. And they talk about this, that, and the other. I see photographs and think, well, where was I? And I work it out and go, oh, yeah, I was probably in Scotland. Oh, yeah, I was probably in America or in Europe somewhere. And so, yeah, we all trade something, don't we?
Exactly, yeah. And I don't think there is still like a huge choice. I mean, when you look at the parental leave, I mean, mums get a lot more than that. And it just kind of falls into the same stereotypes. I personally think if I have to make a choice, I'm going to choose my family, because I know that in, 5, 10, 20 years' time, I'm not going to regret, you know, the meeting I didn't turn up to, the job that I didn't get, or, you know, there's things like that.
Yeah.
There's always going to be more of those, but, you know, family, well, there's only one. But I don't think everyone has that choice, as I say, like when we kind of expect dad to go back to work so soon. I mean, some of them might want to. I don't think everyone wants to, and that's the thing. The choice in still many countries, UK being one of them, is poor.
Mm. Yeah, it is. We are, at the end of the day, we're money driven, but we're money dependent, aren't we? We have to pay the rent, put food on the table, and if we can't, our lives become sad. So money doesn't buy you happiness, but no money buys you sadness, and it's trying to find that middle ground between balancing your family. And I think I found myself making those choices to keep the family alive. And then it becomes what you do. And then it's only when I got into my 50s, I looked back and thought, I want a different second half of my life. I want to do things differently. And I want to see my daughter more, son, and I want to be part of it. My wife and I, we're kind of soulmates now. We spend all of our time together, and we become very codependent on each other, more than a mile apart without pining. So yeah, my attitude to home life and family is changed completely during my 50s. So yeah, I think we have to wake up one day and go, what's really important to me? What do I really want? And almost jettison all that BS of social expectations.
So that's the awakening that I had recently as well. Like, I think, you know, you're told that, you know, to find happiness, you must, you know, study hard so you can get a good job, and then you get your good job, and then you're supposed to marry, and you're supposed to have children, and you should, you know, go up in your career. And at the end, I mean, it doesn't always bring you happiness. Happiness is so much more than that, you know. It's the little moments as well. You find yourself like running someone else's race. I mean, some of the things may be things that you like, but, you know, it's not essentials for happiness. And so, yeah, that was my awakening recently.
Yeah, I'm privileged. I work for myself, and I have worked for myself since the late 90s. So I've got, even though I've had companies where I was responsible for people, I was still top of my food chain. So I could make my own decisions about what I did, when I did it. I was answerable to the bank balance, but not answerable to people other than customers and clients. Yeah, it's an immense amount of freedom that I've experienced in my life. And I think now being able to exercise that freedom, I often call it a life work balance rather than a work life balance, because I live and I use work to keep me living, if you like, rather than living to work. And I think maybe that comes with age. Maybe it just comes with maturity, or just having an epiphany and waking up one day and going, why am I doing this?
Exactly, because, if you go through all the things that you've done, you know, your whole life, this is what you've learned that was the right thing to do, because without that, you know, you're never going to find happiness. But, you know, one day you just learn better because you've gone through the experiences.
Yeah, people often say to me, you know, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self? And I always say, well, I wouldn't give my 10-year-old self any advice because I've turned out okay. I'm cool. But, you know, the key advice would be don't start smoking and watch what you drink and just and don't sweat the small stuff. Yeah, but you look back on it, you know, what advice would I give? And I think definitely it would be give more credence to family and less about work, and then and try and think of a life-work balance earlier in my life, maybe. That would probably be the only thing I would change is to enjoy my family more. Because, as you said, you can't get that back. Once they've grown, you can't get that back. Sonia, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I've really enjoyed our conversation. If people are listening to this, you know, if you're listening to this right now, how can people get a hold of you if they want to have a chat?
Well, I'm in LinkedIn, so I'll be more than happy to speak to anyone who wants to get in touch.
And your LinkedIn profile is Sonia Perez, is that right? Have you searched for you on there?
Yes.
And Perez is Perez. Yeah, and Sonia, Sonia. Yeah. I'll put the details in the show notes. No, thank you. It was a fascinating conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, me too, actually. Yeah, thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.